This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A new name emerges in the federal investigation of nuclear power plant legislation passed in Ohio, and now Governor Mike DeWine is saying he knew nothing about the alleged connection between his Public Utilities Commission chairman and any improper acts involving First Energy. That large utility company on Thursday admitted to bribing public officials to create favorable legislation and agreed to pay $230 million. Let's talk about it now with Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Baumert. Jesse, welcome back to our show.
Always good to be here.
And Columbus Dispatch reporter Laura Bischoff. Laura, thank you for being with us as well.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
If you're listening and have questions or comments about the new developments in this ongoing federal investigation, give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email your thoughts, questions, and comments to talk at wvxu.org. Well, this was quite a week to be on the state beat, I imagine. So I think it would be appropriate first, Jesse, just to recap a little bit about what was new about the announcement on Thursday by federal prosecutors here in the Southern District of Ohio.
Sure. So yesterday, the federal prosecutors announced that First Energy, this Akron-based utility company, it entered into what's called a deferred prosecution agreement. It's kind of like a plea deal. Essentially, they agreed to pay a $230 million fine and disclose information about their political spending and, you know, kind of mind their P's and Q's for 3 years. And if they do all of that and continue to be helpful and turn over records in this federal investigation into corruption at the Ohio State House, if they continue to do that, they will not be prosecuted for the crime that they were charged with. And so this is a big deal for First Energy. It also gave us more insight into how much money they were spending, who they were trying to influence, and that could be a problem for those people who are, you know, listed as influenced.
So, Laura, let's talk about those people who are listed as influenced. Who do we know?
Well, it's interesting. Throughout the 49-page deferred prosecution agreement, the federal prosecutors use pseudonyms. So you have like individual A, individual B, state official one, state official two, executive one, executive two, et cetera. So it's a little bit of a little tricky because, you know, you can make some assumptions, but you're not entirely sure who all is doing what. It does appear that the First Energy folks have provided substantial cooperation and they forked over a bunch of text messages between their executives and public utility, the former Public Utilities Commission of Ohio Chairman Sam Randazzo, who has since resigned, and Larry Householder, Speaker of the House, who has since been expelled. Both Randazzo and Householder say they did nothing wrong. Householder is actually charged in another part of the case, and he's pled not guilty. Randazzo has not been charged with anything.
I know you both co-wrote a deep dive into what's going on with Larry Householder currently. Of course, that was published before the new information that came out on Thursday. We're going to talk a little bit about that exploration of the former Ohio House Speaker coming up a little bit later in this segment. But first, Jesse, let's talk about how federal investigators managed to connect these dots and put Sam Randazzo in this key position.
Yeah. So, I mean, they've been working on it for a couple of years now. So they've been doing a lot of record keeping and so forth. And I imagine they got a lot from First Energy as well. Again, as Laura said, Sam Randazzo hasn't been charged with anything at this point, but the information in the federal filings yesterday, they talk about a $4.3 million payment that was kind of the balance of what he was owed for a contract. And they say that that payment was something First Energy was offering in exchange for favorable treatment, things like help on House Bill 6, which was the piece of legislation that had a $1 billion bailout for two nuclear plants that were owned by First Energy Solutions, now called Energy Harbor. And also, there was a rate case that First Energy was going to have to file in 2024, and that was delayed. And so they're basically making the connection that this money kind of bought First Energy some influence with Randazzo, who was the chair of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio, appointed by Governor Mike DeWine.
And so Governor DeWine did appoint Sam Randazzo as the commissioner of the Public Utilities Commission. But Laura, Randazzo's relationship with this company was well documented. Apparently, it dates back to the previous decade.
Right. Well, in the weeks leading up to that appointment, the governor's office was warned that Randazzo had all these ties to First Energy. And actually, it came out in bankruptcy filings by First Energy Solutions, a former subsidiary of First Energy, that one of Sam Randazzo's companies, Ohio Sustainability Alliance, I think is the name of it, that entity was listed as being owed money by First Energy Solutions. And that came out shortly before Randazzo was about to be appointed. And actually in the deferred prosecution agreement, there was kind of some scramble and worry by the First Energy executives that they weren't going to get Randazzo onto the PUCO.
I want to read a key paragraph from the reporting you all did. Quote, on December 18, 2018, Jones and Executive 2, whose tenure described in court filings matches that of Vice President of External Affairs Michael Dowling, met with Randazzo at his condominium. While there, they discussed the remaining payments on Randazzo's contract set to expire in 2024 and the PUCO appointment. On that same day, the executives dined with Governor Mike DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted at the Athletic Club, according to a Dayton Daily News report. So we did hear from Governor Mike DeWine on a couple of these issues yesterday, his contributions from First Energy and his relationship with Sam Randazzo. I'm hoping that we can explore that a little bit. Jesse, tell us what the governor had to say first about his relationship with Sam Randazzo and whether he knew about any of this going on.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up the exact words, but he effectively said that if Sam Randazzo did anything wrong, if he was acting on behalf of First Energy, that Mike DeWine and his staff didn't know about it. He also said that he would donate all of the political contributions that his campaign committee received from First Energy to the Boys and Girls Club. Now, that's all of the kind of official money, Mike DeWine, and then also his daughter, who was running in a Greene County prosecutor's race, received a decent amount of money through dark money groups from First Energy. And, you know, it would be up to those 501c4s to return that money if they wanted to.
And I mentioned a man named Jones in that paragraph that I cited. I want to note that that was then First Energy CEO Chuck Jones, who was with Executive 2 in that dining situation with the governor and the lieutenant governor at the Athletic Club. I want to just note how brazen these folks were, apparently, in the reports that came out. According to your reporting, when House Bill 6 ultimately passed, Jones sent a Photoshop picture with several faces, including Randazzo's on it. And Jones wrote, quote, HB6... F word, anybody who ain't us. So what is the company doing internally, Laura? I know that the CEO currently put out a video answering or offering up an expanded response to why the company decided to reach the agreement that it did and some changes that it hopes to make.
Yeah, so we found out back in, I think, April that First Energy was in talks to get this deferred prosecution agreement. And really, experts had told me that if they didn't get this agreement and ended up getting charged and convicted, it would have been really bad for a publicly traded company. So First Energy kind of cleared house in October of last year. They fired Chuck Jones, Mike Dowling, and a marketing senior VP named Dennis Chack. And then they also removed other key people in the weeks following. Straw was brought in. He's a longtime First Energy guy. He was elevated to chief executive and then got the permanent job. And they brought more people onto their board. They've done all this compliance work. They've they've kind of changed their posture. And most importantly, they've been cooperating with the feds and kind of forked over, like I said, all this material. And that helped them enormously. Yesterday, Vipal Patel, who is the acting U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, you know, they said that the $230 million fine was discounted based on FirstEnergy's cooperation. I think they could have gotten a much bigger fine had they not been kind of bending over backwards to be helpful.
We're talking with Laura Bischoff from the Columbus Dispatch and Jesse Ballmert from the Cincinnati Inquirer. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. We'll go to the phone lines now where we find Lawrence. Hi, Lawrence. What's your question or comment?
Hey, good afternoon. My question is, and I'm confused about this, so maybe the reporters can help me out. I read that the governor took about $5 million from FirstEnergy or their associates. How do you think that's going to play into the race? And is that something that John Cranley or Nan Wiley can exploit? And I'll take your answer off from here. Thanks.
All right, Lawrence, thanks so much. Jesse and Laura, it sounds like Lawrence is questioning, you know, what is the impact this could have on the governor's race? He specifically mentioned two Democrats either fully in the race or exploring a potential run for governor in the next election cycle. Governor DeWine is probably also going to seek reelection, also facing some potential challenges on the Republican side. What impact could all this have on him?
Well, I'd like to just point out right now, this allegation that he took $5 million from FirstEnergy and its associates is that hasn't been demonstrated publicly anywhere. We don't know what we don't know. So we don't know what kind of money FirstEnergy might have poured into dark money groups that support Team DeWine. But, you know, as far as like disclosed and documented financial support from FirstEnergy to Team DeWine and or dark money groups that supported DeWine and his daughter, I did a tally on that and it came up to be about $1 million. So what was your other question?
No, that establishes, you know, what the relationship might be, I suppose, on the campaign side. But in the world of political campaigns, it doesn't mean that it won't be exploited. And Lawrence's question was about the impact that it could have on his campaign and whether we would expect this to be an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen Data Mayor Nan Whaley already make this an issue. She's running on the Democratic side. She's announced John Cranley as Cincinnati mayor. It's not officially announced, but says he's running. She has already talked about like a several point plan for addressing corruption in her administration. And so I think they're going to hammer this pretty hard. I've already seen Jim Renacci, former congressman who is running on the Republican side, talk about corruption at the State House. So I think you're going to hear a lot about it.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the latest on that news involving state lawmakers and an investigation into federal investigation into FirstEnergy Corp. Learning more about that yesterday. And now we're going to revisit former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder in a deep dive on his background. We're joined by the writers of that latest report, Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmert and Columbus Dispatch reporter Laura Bischoff. So let's talk about Larry Householder. This is somebody who has very confidently expressed his innocence, says he's never taken a bribe from anyone. I don't suppose, Laura, we heard from Larry Householder yesterday?
No, we did not hear from Private Citizen Householder, as he's been calling himself. I expect he'll resurface. He's never been media shy.
Jesse, in the reporting that you two did this week together in exploring what was going on behind the scenes, basically, as Larry Householder tried to navigate this, he was obviously indicted on federal charges, did step down as Speaker of the House, but tried to remain a lawmaker, and for many months did, until his fellow Republicans joined Democrats in ousting him. What surprised you when you were going back and finding what you could in reporting this story?
Yeah, I think the theme that we kept seeing was Larry Householder is lauded for his kind of political prowess and his ability to overcome insurmountable odds. Coming back to be Speaker for a second time and is unusual. It's only been done three times before. So it was quite the feat. And he's very good at kind of building coalitions, getting people together. He's able to kind of, he's a very charismatic person. So I think there's that vision of Larry Householder as this kind of political genius. And then we were able to see kind of behind the scenes, there were things that were less savory, less successful. Some of his like personal business dealings were not as successful as one might think. When he went back to Perry County for a local race after his first turn as speaker and leaving under the guise of a different FBI investigation, he barely eked out this local race where he should have been pretty well known. So there's just a lot of instances where things aren't everything that they seem.
Laura, Larry Householder has found himself on the wrong side of the law multiple times across the course of his career. And why don't we revisit his rocky start in politics? Tell us, you know, I mean, he was convicted of drunken driving and then entered the state house in the early part of the 21st century.
Yeah, so he had a DUI, I think two DUI issues back in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, and then nothing after that. But he entered into the state house as a freshman lawmaker, and I think it became apparent to him that he could run for leadership because term limits was going to kind of create a power vacuum. A number of longtime legislators would be leaving. And so it's my understanding he ran for like the sixth slot on the leadership team, and he won it. And that quickly kind of catapulted him into in line to be speaker. He outmaneuvered this guy, Bill Harris, who was an auto dealer from I think Ashland, and he got to be speaker from 2001 to 2004. And during that time, there was an anonymous memo that came out that accused him and some of his top aides of pay-to-play politics. That triggered an FBI investigation. So when Householder was forced out by term limits in 2004, you know, he went back to Perry County with this FBI thing hanging over his head. The FBI closed the investigation in 2006 without any charges. And then he, you know, like as Jesse detailed, he became Perry County auditor and, you know, barely won that race. And then he was the subject of a couple of state audits, or his office was, where there was questions about the accounting of employee time, et cetera. And then, you know, he decided not to run again for Perry County auditor, saying like, you know, my business interests have taken a lot of my time.
So I'm wondering, Jesse, what is it about Larry Householder, in spite of all this smoke that has surrounded him for so long without any fire necessarily, he has managed to gain power in the Republican Party. He served as speaker twice, as you noted, an unusual feat, and has this weird reputation of kind of being a bit of a bully. What is it about him? What have you learned from maybe other lawmakers or lobbyists, people in the political orbits, that makes this guy such an apparent winner?
Yeah, I think he's very good at building coalitions. I think he's very good at knowing where his numbers are. And that's important in the Ohio House of Representatives and Senates. You need to know who's on your side and who's not on your side. Both times he recruited Republicans to run against other Republicans in order to gain seats that would then support him for the speakership role. But even in late 2018, it wasn't looking great for him. A number of his candidates had lost to Democrats in the general election, and he had to pull out this, speakership battle where he was elected with 26 Republicans and 26 Democrats. He had to go to the Democrats to get the support he needed to become speaker. And, you know, it's not something every Republican politician is willing to do.
I'm wondering about some of his personal expenses and some of his personal financial situation. Laura, what is it that Larry Householder does when he's not in office professionally?
Well, he's had a bunch of different business interests, according to his financial disclosure statements that are filed with the state. He owns a storage business. He's got a bunch of farmland. He's got, he had a few mining companies or mining interests, one of which got sued for fraud, and another ended up getting sued by a bank for an unpaid loan. So, it's kind of an eclectic business interest. I was just going to add to what Jesse was saying about householders' ability to build coalitions.
Sure.
I think he's also very much a political chess player. He thinks long term. He's very ambitious and charismatic. He can play the aw shucks country boy when it suits him, but then he could be very forceful, the forceful politician when it suits him. So I think he's very skilled and a long-term thinker.
I noticed that you all reported that he really doesn't seem to have a lot of personal wealth, apparently, you know, losing his job, which was $67,500 a year as a state representative. And you report that his farm revenue, quote, tanked in 2020. And then he also spent $920,000 of campaign funds on attorneys representing him in this criminal case. And Jesse, this is something that the Ohio Attorney General has says is illegal, right?
Yeah, their Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is questioning whether Larry Householder can use his campaign funds for the personal attorney's fees. That's something that could get sorted out by the Ohio Elections Commission. I imagine that's the least of his concerns with this federal case looming, but that is also something that he might have to address. It costs a lot to defend yourself on federal charges, especially racketeering, which carries up to 20 years in prison. So these are serious charges that cost a lot of money. I think it's probably a financial burden on everyone who is fighting them still.
So what's next for Larry Householder, especially as it relates to this ongoing investigation? He's maintained his innocence, as we've said, but I'm suspecting that he's playing a key role as investigators continue their work on this.
Yeah, there's some sort of a status conference hearing coming up in September. And then maybe after that point, they'll start, Judge Black in U.S. District Court will kind of start to lay out a schedule for going to trial. You know, Householder and former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges are the two that have stuck with their not guilty pleas. Two guys, Jeff Longstreth and Juan Cespedes, they signed plea agreements back in October. Now First Energy is also admitting culpability. And then Neil Clark, who was another guy charged and who pled not guilty, died by suicide in March.
Jesse, what do we know about the mood in Columbus, particularly around the state house? Are there any nerves racking right now?
It's hard to say because I think there's so many people who played some role in the passage of House Bill 6, whether that be helping to craft it, whether that be voting for it, whether that be, you know, having a conversation about whether they would get on board with passing it. I don't think everyone who had a hand in House Bill 6 is going to be charged criminally. I don't think that's the direction the federal officials are going in. But the documents that were provided yesterday, there are a lot of, you know, state officials. There was a lot of people who were working on getting Sam Randazzo to be the next PUCO chairman. So there's a lot in here that could have some people nervous.
I imagine we will have cause to talk about this again, and I'm grateful that the two of you joined us today to spend some time exploring it. Jesse Baumert and Laura Bischoff, thanks to both of you for spending a little bit of your Friday with us.
All right, thanks.
And up next, where Cincinnati Public Schools is on a mask policy as the new school year approaches, and a new bill in Columbus would limit mask mandates in schools and on buses. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The COVID-19 vaccines have proven to be effective, dramatically cutting positive cases and serious illnesses among those of us who have received our shots. But that's not the case for those who haven't. President Biden in Cincinnati on Wednesday called the current situation a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Now local health officials are urging more people to get the vaccine. School districts are weighing what to do about face mask policies in the new school year, and state lawmakers are looking to limit such policies. Joining us now are Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles on Zoom. Joe, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And in the studio with me today are WVXU reporters Becca Costello. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Michael. Happy to be here today.
And Corey Sharber. Hi, Corey.
Hey.
All right, Joe, let's start with you. We got a pretty dire warning from the from a doctor at the Ohio Department of Health, Bruce Vanderhoff. He's saying anyone unvaccinated at this point is at great risk of contracting COVID. And that's because this pandemic is not over. And are we getting that message from the health department, just as we did from President Biden himself, that this is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated?
Yes, we are getting that message from the health department as well. Dr. Vanderhoff says it's a matter of not if, but when you get COVID if you're unvaccinated. We are seeing some breakthrough cases. We aren't getting a lot of them, but we are seeing some of those breakthrough cases. That's people who have been vaccinated, yet they still get COVID. But those cases tend to be lighter and not land people in the hospital as often. The serious cases that we're seeing right now are coming from, you know, people who are unvaccinated. And, you know, down in your area, Dr. Patty Manning Courtney of the Cincinnati Children's Hospital, she's saying that this is really dangerous to kids. You know that 0 to 12 years old, they cannot be vaccinated if they're under 12. And she says that they've had 350 kids vaccinated this past year in her hospital alone, 12,000 kids who were not hospitalized but were sick enough to be hospitalized, all with COVID. So this is a real issue for a lot of people, and it's mainly hitting unvaccinated Ohioans.
I think you meant to say 350 kids hospitalized during the past year, including babies.
Right. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. I'm not sure what I said.
You said vaccinated. That's okay. We sometimes get a little lost when we're talking live. No big deal.
It's been a long week, Mike.
Indeed it has. We've made it to Friday, mercifully. We've just got about 20 minutes left to fill on this show, and then we're all off on our weekend. So, but we are talking, of course, about something very serious here. And you know, we've got this trial going on here at Cincinnati Children's Hospital evaluating the efficacy of vaccines on kids under 12. And so we are looking forward to the results of that. And it could be this fall when kids are getting their jabs. In the meantime, let's talk about what kids might be seeing in some of the local school districts and what local health officials are saying. That's why we're also joined today by WVXU reporters Becca Costello and Corey Sharber. Becca, we are hearing similar messages from local health officials, are we not? That if you're not vaccinated, you are quite vulnerable to this pandemic that is not yet over.
Absolutely. And that's not really a new message. I mean, the Get Out the Vax campaign has been a huge push for local health officials. What has been new in the last couple of weeks, of course, is the increase in cases, which does increase the risk. And then this Delta variant that is more highly contagious than the original strain of the virus. And so folks are saying, you know, you're at even higher risk than you were previously, and really just kind of pushing folks to get vaccinated if they haven't yet.
What are we seeing in the way of numbers?
Well, talking about kids first, you know, obviously the vaccines in the U.S. so far are just approved for people age 12 and up. But those younger groups have the lowest rates of vaccination. That's true across the country, but also here regionally. So, for example, in Kentucky, we learned this week for 18 to 29-year-olds, only 36% have been vaccinated, compared to an overall rate for Kentucky of about 51%. So definitely seeing those lower numbers. And that's true. The data is a little bit harder to be specific about for those under age 18 because the census data is a little bit wonky. But we're seeing similar trends there as well.
And we are, of course, and it's the older population has been so heavily hit. We've seen that most of the deaths from COVID are the older population, and the numbers seem to be pretty good as it relates to them, that portion of the population and their rates of vaccination. But it is young people that are falling off of it, and it's their numbers that are ticking up in states all around. And the troubling thing about it being young people is that schools are coming back, and it looks like schools, Corey, are planning to be open, much in the way they tried to in the previous school year, and not so much in a hybrid format. We expect to have people back in the building, but school districts are trickling out their policies en masse. The big one, though, Cincinnati Public Schools, the largest district in the region, no decision yet on whether kids are wearing face masks?
Right. So there's a series of recommendations they made in light of COVID-19, and they are recommending students to everyone in the buildings to wear masks, but they haven't reached a final decision yet. That decision will be made at a later policy and equity committee meeting or at a future board regular meeting.
Well, were they supposed to make a decision previously and did not?
I'm not sure about that. I feel like they could have made a decision earlier if they wanted to. I think it's really the main issue is it's sort of tied up with, you know, the ever-changing CDC recommendations on top of some of the things we're seeing going on in the Ohio State House right now with certain bills coming in that I believe it was in the Senate that was recommended that there was a bill that wanted to ban like public schools and, yeah, and universities and whatnot to do away with mask requirements. And that, I think, with that being in the back of everyone's minds on Monday evening, that sort of kind of pushed them away from making a final decision at the time.
If you're listening and have questions or comments about masks and schools or vaccines and vaccine hesitancy, please give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email your thoughts, comments, questions to talk at WVXU.org. We're joined by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles and WVXU reporters Becca Costello and Corey Sharber. Joe, we heard Corey just mention that legislation sponsored by Republican Senator Andrew Brenner, I believe, from Delaware.
From Delaware, yes. And he, you know, he thinks that, you know, these businesses and public schools, public entities that are requiring masks, he thinks that it's setting up discrimination against people who are not vaccinated, are not wearing masks. He doesn't like it and wants to make sure that discrimination isn't occurring. But what we're seeing is that first of all, there was a law that was signed into, it was a bill that was signed into law last week that says that public and public colleges and public K through 12 schools cannot require students, staff to be vaccinated. But that's not going into effect until October. So we're starting to see some schools, some colleges, public and private both, saying, hey, we want everyone vaccinated before they come through our doors in the fall. And the ones that aren't are looking at masking as a real way to prevent the spread of coronavirus, especially when we're seeing these new variants, the Delta variant that's coming in, very, very contagious and can very easily be passed, and children are getting it. So, you know, there's a lot of worry out there right now, and people who are running schools are really, they're between a rock and a hard place because they're getting it from all angles.
Yeah, you know, over the course of the pandemic, as it relates to schools and whether kids should be inside actual classrooms or learning virtually, we saw a lot of criticism lodged at teachers and their labor unions, for example, for taking the position that schools should be virtual as frequently as possible, really to protect the teachers who were certainly more vulnerable to being ill from the COVID virus than the students. But what are we hearing from teachers, Joe?
The teachers, I talked to a couple of teachers unions heads who they've been talking to their members, and they're saying that teachers are concerned. They're very concerned, but mostly the teachers have been vaccinated. So now the concern really turns to the kids, and especially those kids who cannot be vaccinated. And remember, 0 through 11, they cannot be vaccinated.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We'll go to the phone lines now where we find Carson. Hi, Carson. What's your question or comment?
My question was about the likelihood of what you were just talking about a few minutes ago, about whether it was likely that the state government would pass some sort of bill that would prohibit or from having a mask mandate in the public schools. As a CPS parent who is very happy with the school that my kids attend, you know, with all of this kind of playing politics with our kids in school, I feel like there's more likelihood I'd be withdrawing, especially my youngest daughter, from CPS and going to a school where I know that she can be masked and the unvaccinated kids are masked so that the teachers are protected and the kids are protected. And I just wonder, what is the likelihood of the state government doing something which I think is just kind of nonsense.
All right, Carson, we will take your question and we'll hang up and start to answer that. Joe Carson wants to know, I mean, we talked about that piece of legislation that's being sponsored from the Republican senator from Delaware, Delaware, Ohio, of course. Does he have support for that from other members of the caucus or the legislature?
Well, there is some support. Yes, of course there is. But will it be passed? That's the question. If you look at what was passed as far as vaccines, that was very watered down from what had started out as the first bill that went out there. I think we're going to see the same with masks. And Governor DeWine, he signed that vaccine bill, but even when he signed it, he pointed out that it only refers to COVID vaccines or vaccines that are used on an experimental basis. And once that COVID vaccines are given FDA approval for full use, and we're hearing from President Biden that that could even be in August sometime. Once that happens, that law that he just signed that said that, you know, the schools, the public universities could not require vaccinations, it becomes a moot point at that point because it's only pertaining to experimental vaccines.
And let's note that U.S. Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell of Kentucky came out pretty strong again this week. He's been strong all along on masks and vaccines, but reiterated this week that if restrictions are to come down, it's because people won't be vaccinated. If people are wearing masks again, it's because people won't be vaccinated. Corey, let's talk a little more about Cincinnati Public Schools, for example, and the conversations about whether there will be masks involved. What type of opposition are you hearing, if any?
Well, from one of the board members, Eve Bolden, she mentioned that she just didn't understand why we would need to be wearing masks in the buildings, which is interesting because, you know, more than 70% of the teachers within CPS are vaccinated. But for students, we don't have a lot of data for students within CPS. But in Hamilton County, 29% of the students, 29% of students in Hamilton County aged 12 to 14 are vaccinated, whereas for people ages 15 to 19, that's only 37%. So you have still just with this data, you have a pretty huge gap as far as, the vaccinations teachers are getting compared to the students. And I think it's interesting that noting, some of the discussions that they were involved Monday evening kind of revolved around, well, if they're not wearing masks in buildings, why do they have to wear masks on the bus? And it's like, well, if you have all of these back and forth discussions, it's kind of interesting that they're still hesitant to even just go forward with the masking, since that's what they were doing last year anyway.
We saw Kenton County Schools, one of the large districts in Northern Kentucky, come out and say that there will be masks on buses, but not mandated inside buildings. Boone County is not requiring masks at all. Boone County is the largest district in Northern Kentucky and the third largest in all of Kentucky. Becca, as it relates to local health departments, did we hear any speculation or warnings that there could be restrictions revisited? Obviously, they don't necessarily have the authority to do that on their own. But was there any type of warning like what we heard from Senator McConnell that, look, get it together, go get your vaccine, or you're going to be wearing masks and we're going to be locked down again?
It's a good question. I think it does vary depending on, who you talk to. I will say we did have some strong words from Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear this week, saying not a requirement at this point, but recommending that some even fully vaccinated people should start wearing masks again, that folks who are immunocompromised or have other maybe underlying health conditions, and also folks who are just working in jobs that put them in contact with a lot of people, since the vaccination rate is so low and it's not growing very quickly. So some recommendations there, but again, not a requirement. And so far, at least I haven't heard him threaten that that will become a requirement. I did talk to a couple of local health departments in Ohio counties this week, and I asked them that question and said, is this something that you're recommending for fully vaccinated folks or just in general? And they both told me that in this case, they're really focusing on folks who are not vaccinated. So they're not changing the guidance for people who are vaccinated in terms of masking. They're not saying that widespread masking is likely at this point. They're saying, if you're unvaccinated, that's where the risk is, and that's where they're focusing a lot of their attention.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. What's your question or comment?
Well, my daughter just turned 12, and so I'm anxious to get her vaccinated. We use the Cincinnati Health Department clinics often, and we like them. So I called there, and I was so surprised. Maybe somebody can clarify. The receptionist said that the Cincinnati Health Department is not giving shots, vaccinations to kids 12 through 18. Now, I was able to find it at Kroger Little Clinic, the one in, I forget which one, has walk-in available. So that's not an issue, but I was still surprised. Does someone know if that's true and why?
We might be able to explore that, but you were able to find a vaccine for your daughter who's now over the age of 12.
Yes. I mean, right. So it's not like it's a huge problem, but on the other hand, there is another thing I was going to mention. On the other hand, if they were doing it, then I would think that they could increase the number of people getting vaccines by simply, putting it in your face, so to speak.
Okay.
Speaking to that, the school she goes to did in fact have vaccines available last year, toward the end of the year. And she, of course, wasn't old enough. But so there was a receptionist, the same receptionist that said the Cincinnati Health Department isn't doing that, giving 12 through 18, said that the individual schools can do it on an individual basis, is what she believed.
Okay. So, well, we appreciate the call, Mark, and thank you so much for sharing some thoughts with us and taking the time to call in.
And Michael, I can address that
please,
just a little bit, if that's okay. I think probably the most likely scenario here is that, just a reminder, only one of the three vaccines approved for emergency use in the United States is approved for anyone under the age of 18. And so that is the Pfizer vaccine. And I think likely this is a supply issue, that the particular clinic that you called didn't have the Pfizer vaccine on hand and maybe only had the other two. It is a great point, though, that you bring up in terms of, making it as accessible as possible. That's definitely what we're hearing from health officials, that we want to make it as easy as possible to get the vaccine. Some folks are choosing not to because they have concerns, even related to some misinformation. But some folks say, I'm busy, I just haven't gotten around to it. And for that crowd, they're really trying to meet people where they are with the vaccine. So it's a good question in terms of, like you said, it's pretty easy to get. You can kind of walk into almost any Walgreens or Kroger or CVS and get a vaccine on the spot. But again, with folks trying to make it as easy as possible, that's something that they might want to consider.
And we are joined today by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles on Zoom and WVXU reporters Becca Costello and Corey Sharber in the studio. And you all are in the studio. This is the first news review we've done with reporters in the studio since the world fell apart, a year and a half ago. And that is because of vaccinations. We know that earlier this year, when vaccines started to roll out, that it was hard to get one. We had to wait for certain age groups or industries, and those of us who wanted it couldn't get in there fast enough. And then it's opening up to everyone, and you've seen it slow down. You can't swing a cat without hitting an opportunity to get a vaccine. They're basically in the vending machine down the hall at this point, if you want one. Joe, I'm wondering, we saw an uptick in vaccinations when Governor DeWine offered up, that $1 million prize if you agreed to get vaccinated. Are we seeing any possibility of a return to that sort of game show aspect to get people vaccinated?
Well, he's talked about doing other incentives that wouldn't be as big as the incentive that they had, which was basically $1 million a week to someone who was 18 and over, or if you were in that 12 to 17 year age group, it was a 4-year college tuition. And they did that 4 consecutive weeks. And we saw that first couple of weeks, the numbers went a little higher, but it wasn't anything earth-shattering. We didn't see people just, all of a sudden coming in and getting vaccines. And so I don't know. He has not announced new incentives. He's trying to work with businesses to get them. But I think when they do incentives, they're going to try to tailor them more to different groups or different places where they're seeing some hesitancy.
We don't know of anything locally, right? I mean, we haven't heard anything on the Kentucky side or any return to that as these things start to fall apart.
Incentive-wise, no, I haven't heard anything. Again, they're kind of pushing for just trying to meet people places. For example, the Hamilton County Health Commissioner recently said their mobile bus has been going to places like breweries And they're not getting big vaccination numbers there. But his point was, you know, if we're there for 2 hours and only get four people vaccinated, that's four people that would not have been vaccinated otherwise because they weren't likely to go elsewhere.
I know you went to Italian Fest over the previous weekend in Newport, which they were able to bring back again because things were improving, are improving as far as the pandemic goes. But we are seeing these scary upticks in things. But there was a booth there that was offering free vaccinations against COVID-19. A firm based in Newport was offering these up.
That's right.
Did you see anybody go in?
I didn't. And they were offering just walk-ins, but they also had appointments online. So it could be that, you know, they had a lot of appointments during the time that I wasn't there. And it was over the course of a couple days and I only went for one afternoon. But, you know, lots of people there and it was kind of cool to see people all in one place again, but not a lot of activity at the vaccination booth.
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, it's so exciting to see crowds returning to places. It's so nice to eat in a restaurant, to maybe sit at a bar, to go anywhere where there are other people, especially family that you hadn't seen in a while. You can congregate. But now I'm wondering if there's going to be a suspicion emerging among folks. You know, we're supposed to trust each other because technically, if you're not vaccinated, you should still be wearing a mask in some of these places. But now I'm not seeing any mask in stores and in restaurants. And we see the percentage of people who are vaccinated. And so I'm wondering how we're going to be looking at one another as we move forward. I want to say thank you and goodbye to Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles. Joe, thank you for all the fantastic reporting you and your team does there at the State House News Bureau. We always appreciate you spending some time with us.
Well, thank you.
Before we let you all get on with your weekend, Corey, I know that there is some other news to report or not to report. Cincinnati Public Schools is looking for a new superintendent. What's the update on that?
Right. There hasn't really been too much to report from that, but they have developed a timeline. They will start searching for a new superintendent, and they hope to make that decision by the end of August, and they're going to hire an executive search firm to help out with the process. And they believe this week they have submitted a request for a proposal to get the executive search firm.
And we know that the Cicada podcast has ended. Cicadas are long gone. That's one plague that has ended. So we're excited about that. But you all just did a live video that's still available on our Facebook page where those of you who are missing conversations about those dastardly bugs can go on our Facebook page and watch the last conversation with Dr. Kritsky about this. It was a fun little recap where you took some final questions.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot. I mean, there's still a lot of new things we covered in it, too. There's just so much information about cicadas.
We'll look forward to the second series of that in 2038 when you and Dr. Kritsky undoubtedly get together and do round two. Corey Sharber, Becca Costello from right here at WVXU. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our live Facebook stream was produced by Ronnie Salerno. This theme music composed by Rob Fetters. Find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. Hope you all have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again on Monday.